Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees. Tour de France is well underway for 2013, and the first week has been pretty exciting. Day one was especially gripping when a team bus became wedged under the finish line banner only a few minutes before the first riders were to come through. And because of the chaos, when there was uncertainty as to whether the bus could be moved in time, there was also a mammoth pileup about 5 kilometers out, which caused injury and equipment failures that would have consequences during the team time trial. It was very messy. So the injured rider, USA rider Ted King, was summarily eliminated. Even though he had a separated shoulder and was riding with his team, he failed to meet the time trial criteria by 7 seconds. There was a lot of uproar on social media, hoping that the officials would change their minds, but they stuck by their decisions, and Ted King is officially out of the race. Meanwhile, I want to get right to this week's show because it is about the Tour de France, at least the first half. It's actually about the 99 previous Tours de France. Author Graham Fife has undertaken to write one of the most definitive and interesting books about the history, the legend, and the riders of the most grueling and exciting of sporting events. Tour de France is an impressive in-depth view of this most famous of events and brings us right up to Wiggins' 2012 victory. Graham's intense research, combing through years of race logs and reaching back into history, brings details to his over 500-page book that most of us may never have known. I know I certainly learned a lot. Graham will be with me in a moment. So in the second half of the show, we're going to talk about and to kids. From a youngster who is now a BMX champion but might instead have been one of the forgotten children of poverty and drug-addicted parents, to the group who once again travels from New York City to tour the Underground Railroad Tour from the Bronx Lab School, we're going to talk about how kids are still riding and thriving because of the bicycle. I'll first speak with Scott Embry, whose adopted son Cyrus has been riding and racing since he was a little boy. Actually, he's not much more than a little boy right now, but he currently holds the number 4 spot in the U.S. standings in his age group, and his dad, Scott, is 100% behind his son's efforts. Then we're going to talk with Chuck Harmon, probably one of the most generous of cycling folks from right here in Central Ohio, as he brings his kids from the Bronx Lab School in New York City to facilitate a bike tour that covers around 300 miles. This year's group, each of whom will receive credit for the tour, will camp, prepare their own meals, visit 2 colleges, and learn about the Underground Railroad and what it meant to those who escaped slavery. So let's get right to it. I'd like to welcome author Graham Fife to The Outspoken Cyclist. Graham, thanks for joining me this evening.
Pleasure.
Where are you in the UK?
I'm in Sevenoaks in Kent, which is just southeast of London. Wonderful countryside. I'm looking out at trees, a patch of woodland at the back of my house.
Nice.
Yeah, it's very good.
Well, I thought it was a good time to talk to you during the 100th edition of the Tour de France to discuss your new book, Tour de France, The History, The Legend, The Riders. It is quite the book.
Yeah, it's not actually new. It was first published in Britain in 1999, which accounts for the size of it, because I've updated every tour since. I've finished with, well, I suppose it was the 97 or 98 I finished it. And so I've updated it every year since. And so it started off at 200 pages, and now it's surging on towards 600.
What made you decide to undertake such an enormous project as 100 years of the tour?
It goes back a long way. I had a French girlfriend in the 70s, and I therefore became acquainted with the Tour de France. I've been a cyclist all my life. It's a physical passion. I love the feeling of freedom. In fact, when I first rode a bike, it was the thought that I could escape, which most excited me. But I came to the Tour de France through the French sources, the French magazines, the French books. I didn't see the tour for a long, long time, but that's where the flame of curiosity, enthusiasm started. And I suppose I began a lifelong study of the race, many aspects of it, but I came from a French perspective. It's their race, it's deep in their psyche, and so I have a very different take, I think, on it. I wanted to get inside, if I could, the mystique of the race. I mean, it's not a comprehensive history, that would be ridiculous, absurd, just a massive book, but I wanted to find out what it was about this race, about the men who ride it, and why it has such a grip on the public fascination for it.
It does, doesn't it? Yes, that's true. So mm-hmm. One of the most interesting things that I found in the book was how you delve into history. You give us a background around which we can position the tour and its effects. So how did you decide to include all this world history? I mean, some of the things you say are so interesting, and some of the pieces and parts of history you bring in.
Well, it began as an account of a visit to the Alps that I made with two friends in 1995. We began in Grenoble, and then the first Alp I ever rode was Alpe d'Huez, which wasn't a very smart choice, I must say. But it's having been embroiled in my study of the Tour for a long time, of course I was going to have to ride the mountains. I mean, and the moment came, we got back, and I began writing a memoir of that trip. And gradually, over a fair long period, I stripped out the account of our ride and put more about the tour itself, to juxtapose my own experience of the mountains with accounts of the men who'd ridden the tour. So it was a long and slow evolution, really.
Well, it's fascinating. It's fascinating. So let's delve into the book a little bit. And the first thing I didn't know was that the tour actually started as a publicity stunt. How did that happen?
Well, in the late 1900s, 1800s, there was a man called Dreyfus, an officer who was accused of spying. He was sent to Devil's Island. There was a big furore about it, and it divided France. There were those who thought that he was innocent and he's being stitched up, others who thought, no, he's guilty. The bicycle manufacturer Comte Dion had put a lot of publicity with a newspaper called Le Vélo, which is French for bicycle. Pierre Giffard, the editor, was for Dreyfus. Comte Dion was against him. So he said, right, I'm taking my publicity away. And he founded another newspaper. He called it L'Auto Vélo, the car bicycle. Giffard said, you've got to drop Vélo. Comte Dion said, no. Giffard took him to court, and so the new paper had to be called L'Auto. And that was in 1902. 1903, first Tour de France. The editor of the new the new newspaper was Henri Desgranges, and he thought, well, Le Vélo sells 80,000 copies. We need to match that. How about a bike race? And that's how it started. By then, there was quite a big calendar of long, long bike rides. They like to send people off for 20 hours, 30 hours, 40 hours, whatever, on a bike. So that's how it started, to publicize the race.
Interesting. So then, moving on, who was Raymond Poulidor, and what was his role early on?
Well, Raymond Poulidor was a rider in the 60s. His real fame, I suppose, comes from the rivalry with Jacques Anquetil, who was, the first man to win five tours. And the rivalry was real. I've interviewed Poulidor. I had a long talk with him on one occasion. And I said, was the rivalry real? And he says, oh, yes, absolutely. It wasn't just talked up by the press. But it was really, it was the two heroes of French cycling, Poulidor, the peasant from the Limousin, came from very humble background, what you'd call a sharecropper in the States, I guess. You know, he had to be bought his first bike, you know, and he came to racing, and he had an absolutely dazzling talent. But then there was Anquetil, who was ruthless racer, very, very good with other riders. And while the public thought Poupou was, as they called him, was the man, you know, warm-hearted and all the rest, the other riders didn't like him terribly much because he was a peasant. He was tight-fisted. Anquetil, very, very generous. The public didn't like him because he didn't play up to them. So it was really the polarity of the rivalry between these two men, which really gave a terrific injection of you know, excitement for the journalists to write about. And famously, in 1964, they wrote up the Puy de Dôme, which is a volcanic plug in the south of France. And it was Anquetil's last victory. But the two of them rode up this ghastly climb, elbow to elbow, followed by the bikes and the cars, and Poulidor finally went away from Anquetil. Anquetil was absolutely stressed out of all contention. But Poulidor took only, I think it was something like 50 seconds, from Anquetil, who was still ahead by 13 seconds. And when he was asked, well, it's only 13 seconds, and he said, it's 12 more than I need. And it's a way of his saying, well, Poulidor, you missed your chance. Is that all you've got? He did actually say afterwards that if he'd lost the yellow jersey that day, he would have gone home. Huh. Poulidor never wore the yellow jersey, although he had bags of talent to do it. But somebody said about him, Raymond, vous êtes insaisissable, which means I really don't get you. there was something odd in his character. He held back from I don't know, full exploitation of his talent.
I'd like to take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Graham Fife. He is in the UK. His book, Tour de France, The History, the Legend, the Riders, is now up to date through Tour number 99. I guess you're going to have to add Tour 100 after the next couple of weeks, huh?
I'm bracing myself for it.
It's been an interesting tour so far. So
yeah, sure.
You use the mountain stages sort of as a backdrop for your first seven chapters, which is kind of interesting. Can you take us through how you decided to title these chapters for the cols or mountains to lay out your accounts of the tour?
Yeah, the great thing about the Tour de France is you can watch it from the side of the road. It's free. And you can ride the same roads that the riders themselves ride. Now, riding a flat stage is not terribly interesting. Unless you happen to be in a lovely part of France, that's fine. I'm not decrying that. But it's the mountains where the real battlefield of the Tour has always been located. That's where it's won. That's where it's lost. That's where it's taken away from really good riders by a crash, an accident, or whatever, a stunning attack by a rival, an unseen rival. So it's the mountains, really, which is the forum of the intense competition. And so that's why I went to ride them myself. But to locate it on those alpine peaks seemed at the time, if you like, it was the peg on which to hang the story. I mean, since then I've ridden the Pyrenees, I've written a book about the Pyrenees, I've written two books about the Alps, also, which you can find on my website, let's say. So it was it was for that reason. So it was purely a literary device, but it was also to point up the essential and central drama of the race.
Well, and within each of these chapters, of course, you can go forward and backward in time, which is what I find so interesting. Even though we talk about the 1930s, you might bring in something a little more recent or a little before that. It's just a really, you could pick up any chapter of the book, but it does help to read it through. I do realize there is a chronological sort of thread through the book. So it's sometimes the little details that make the book so real to me. So, for example, in chapter 4, I think I'll try to pronounce this, Col du Galibier.
Yeah.
The 1930s. You talk about a rider named Koblet. Tell us the story of the 1951 tour and why he was, quote, the best groom rider, unquote, on the tour. I thought that was a cute story.
Well, he was somebody else called him the Pédaleur de Charme, a very charming man. By all accounts, he was a delight to talk to, always had a smile, very friendly with the other riders. Women flocked to him. He was very, very handsome. And he was a very, very classy rider. In that tour, he won by 22 minutes, which is pretty amazing gap.
Yeah.
But he, I mean, I don't know why he did it, other than to say that in bike racing, there's what we call in England kidology goes on, i.e. psyching. Small example, somebody overtook me once. I saw them go past and I thought, oh, I can't be bothered. They got 100 yards and I thought, to hell, I can't be bothered. So flew after them, got their back wheel. And before I overtook them, I pulled out a banana from my back pocket, peeled it and cycled past eating it. Now, it's a way of saying, you know, okay, fella, I'm cool, you know. if he'd had the balls, pardon my French, to chase me, I'd have been dead, but he didn't. Now, Koblet carried always a little bottle of eau de cologne and a comb, because when he finished, he liked to be neat. He liked to come across the line looking as if he had not had anything other than a bit of a casual ride on his bike. Cycle past another rider up a mountain, takes out his comb, decombs his hair, as if to say, well, pal, I'm doing fine. Isn't it great scenery, you know? So it's his, that's really the essence of why he did that. And of course, you know, in a sport where they came in covered in grime and sweat and all the rest, there was Koblet looking as neat as if he just stepped out of a saloon, you know?
I just thought that was one of the more fun pieces of information that I, again, the book is filled with these little stories that people have probably never heard. So you talk about the Touriste Routier. How did the Touriste Routier play into, and what was it? Who was he?
Well, he was an independent, a freelance rider in the early years. Somebody who didn't have sponsorship from a team, and sponsorship from a team in those days, largely it was bicycle manufacturers, naturally. They didn't sponsor a great many riders. And so the Touriste Routier went into the tour, did everything himself. He had to find his own hotels, his own meals. They all had to pay for everything. I mean, he had to do his own repairs, but so did the rest. However, he operated completely independently and was there to win prizes.
Uh-huh.
You know, he could take take some money on a what they call a prime. You know, there's a money for getting over hills, a mountain first, money for arriving certain place first. You know, that kind of thing. So they were just that, the free roving cyclists who didn't have teams. That's all. But some of them were terrific riders.
Well, that was my question. So that whole idea of an individual being able to enter the tour, when did that go away? Obviously, no longer can somebody just show up at the line and independently ride the Tour de France.
No. Well, I've been asked if I've ridden the Tour de France. You know, I think there's less ignorance about it now. It finished really after the First World War, I think. I mean, those years, I'm not absolutely precise, but when teams got more organized and so it became less feasible, let's say, for an individual to ride on his own.
Got it. So yeah. I guess we really need to talk about the history of drugs in the Tour, because it is not a short history. In fact, it seems to be quite a long history. Let me ask one question first. Why did Jacques Anquetil oppose drug testing?
Well, he's on record as saying everyone's taken them.
Aha.
He said you don't ride a big race like the Bordeaux-Paris, which is something like 300 miles, on mineral water. And then he said rather elliptically, small trees don't grow in the jungle. So my feeling is that he probably thought, well, if everybody is doing it, how can you pick out individuals? I don't know. But one must stress that the difference between drug taking now and drug taking then was that by and large then it was to mask fatigue. In the early days, in the 1920s, they used to take wine laced with strychnine. Strychnine is a poison, as you know. In small doses, it's atomic and a stimulant. They rubbed, they took cocaine, which dulls pain. I mean, as a kid, I used to have cocaine injections at the dentist. You know, this is on a national health.
Right.
They rubbed chloroform into their gums because they got neuralgia because it was cold, and, you know, just all sorts of stuff. Because these guys were riding 20 hours, you know? I mean, just to stay on the bike was a problem. What changed was the introduction of performance-enhancing drugs, testosterone, corticoids, and growth hormones, and notably EPO, which is erythropoietin, which is a drug developed originally for people who suffered from anemia, and it was to enhance the quantity of red blood corpuscles in the bloodstream. More oxygen gets round. It thickens the blood, which is not a good idea. But it did. It couldn't turn a cart horse into a stallion, but it could turn a man who had only ever come second into a winner. That's the big difference. Somebody asked me, you know, isn't the Tour de France too hard? Is that why they take drugs? And I said, no. It's always been too hard. That's the point. Henri Desgrange said an ideal tour would be one which only one rider had the strength to finish. Now, that's the basis on which he set this bike race up. But they take drugs not just to get round, but to do well. That's the difference. And, you know, if they pop the stuff, they can do better.
And that is true. But so things have changed because of the idea of having to win, you know, sort of like I have to win instead of.
Yeah. I mean, you know, given the you win the Tour de France. I mean, that's it. You don't have to worry about money probably for the rest of your life. I mean, it's the big race in bike racing to win. It always has been pretty amazing to just to finish the tour, but to win it, wow! So you know, a lot is riding on it. An Olympic gold medal. I mean, it all. You know, in this day and age, you know, the tour is a global event, and so the prize is commensurately large.
It is indeed, and that's what I want to talk about right now, which is no book about the tour would be complete without the explanation of the jerseys and how the jerseys work and what's associated with the jerseys in terms of prize money. So can you briefly tell us how each of these jerseys is connected to the prizes?
Yeah, the yellow jersey, I should have mentioned earlier that Lotto, the newspaper which publicized the tour and sponsored it, was printed on yellow paper. In 1919, the first tour after the First World War, it was run. It was called the Tour of Regeneration. France had been shattered by the First World War. And somebody said, look, why don't we have a way of marking out the guy who's leading the race? And somebody said, well, okay, put him in a, you know, it's the colour of the newspaper. So reputedly, they had to go round to a department store and find something which was vaguely the shape of a racing jersey, which was yellow, and they gave it to the guy who was leading. And it wasn't popular to begin with. The riders were saying, hey, if I'm wearing the yellow, right, everybody's going to attack me.
Right.
I don't want that, you know. But it evolved, and as teams began to operate as teams, I mean, really after the Second World War, up till then, not really so much. But then it became the great mark of distinction. I mean, in France, they call it le toison d'or, the golden fleece, as in the myth. Le maillot jaune is, it's all the cachet, prestige, esteem and renown that you care to squash together. and plant on one person's back and shoulders. The green jersey, which... So the yellow jersey is won by the guy who has the least time for the distance covered. So a guy can actually win the yellow jersey without ever winning a stage. This is... Yeah, but think of Formula One. You know, so a guy can win Formula One without ever winning a race.
Right.
Simple analogy. I mean, you know, it's not complicated. It's not rocket science, let's say. the green jersey was introduced in 1953. It was sponsored by the French Totalizator, you know, the betting. And it was for the man who finished most consistently high in each stage. And it was nothing to do with time. It was counted down 1 to 20. So a guy who's getting more higher places each day accumulates points, and he wins the green jersey at the end of the race. The polka dot jersey, which is the red dots on the white, was introduced in 1975. Now, this is for the mountains, the guy who accumulates most points. Over the mountains, there are five categories of mountain, going from fourth category, which is fairly simple, short, not so steep, up to hors category, which they say that's beyond category, serious stuff, you know. The mountains prize itself was introduced first in 1933, but not until 1975 did they have a special jersey to denote the leader in that competition. It was sponsored by a chocolate manufacturer. One of their chocolate bars had a white wrapper with red dots on. Bingo. The same year, 1975, white jersey for the best young rider under 25 on January the 1st of the year that the tour is in. And, you know, that's some of the guys who've won it. Laurent Fignon won it in the year that he won the tour. Jan Ullrich, same. So it's, you know, it marks out a potential winner. Who knows?
And each of those jerseys are worth a lot of money.
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, I haven't got the figures in front of me.
Right.
I mean, I could turn up the page now, but, I mean, you know, it's a big chunk of change, you know, that they take in. And they also get paid an amount each day that they wear it. So it's valuable. And in the old days, it probably still happens, but not so much now because riders are paid so much more. In the old days, a winner of the tour would divide up his winnings amongst his team men. He'd give it all away to them because he owed his victory in large part to them, their support.
Sure.
And he was going to make shed loads of money from the post-tour sponsorship and all the rest that came to him.
Yes, we know that money seems to be the root of all problems when it comes to everything from doping to jerseys, you know.
Yeah, money is at the root of it. I mean, it's a big business operation, this one.
So if you were to take bets this year, do you have a favorite in the tour?
Oh, yeah, Chris Froome.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's not because I'm British. I interviewed him last year, actually. I was very impressed with him. He's had an amazing season so far. And he's certainly the man in form. He's got a very good team round him. Alberto Contador has not shown much form recently, but he has won this race twice, and you can't count him out. I don't really see anybody coming up, popping out of the pack. But... who knows? I mean, this is the Tour de France. You can't be sure of anything. But, you know, I think Chris Froome is, he's the man to beat, I think.
Well, I have to say that it'll be interesting to have you add chapter 100, really. It's the 100th year to your book. It's been a delight to talk with you. I wish we had more time. The book is Tour de France, The History, the Legend, the Riders by Graham Fyfe. He's in the UK and... following the tour as we are here in the States. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Pleasure, Diane. Pleasure.
All right. Have a great day.
You too.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Graham Fife joined me from his home in England to talk about his book, Tour de France, The Riders, The Legend, The History. What a great guy. He's probably forgotten more about the Tour de France than I will ever know. I'm going to take a short break, and after the break, we'll have some news, and then we're going to rush on out to Chandler, Arizona, and talk with Scott Embry. We'll be right back on The Outspoken Cyclist.
This entire piece of music was played with only two instruments, a right hand and a left hand. Hands can do incredible things, but nothing compares to using them to help save a life with hands-only CPR. If an adult suddenly collapses, call 911, then push hard and fast in the center of their chest until help arrives. Hands-only CPR is recommended by the American Heart Association, and it's incredibly easy and effective. Find out more about this latest method of CPR at handsonlycpr.org. The power to help save a life is in your hands. A message from the American Heart Association and the Ad Council.
We all share a common journey. We wanted to serve our country and protect the things we love. But for some of us, coming home was more of a challenge than we expected. In the service, we had each other's backs, but as veterans, it can sometimes feel like we're all alone.
For confidential support, call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Chat at veteranscrisisline.net or text 838-255.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We are back on the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm going to catch you up on some news, and then we'll head on out to Chandler, Arizona, and talk with Scott Embry. So the first thing I'd like to talk about is about kids, because the second half of our show is about kids, and we don't often give our kids enough credit. So I'm going to start the news off with this piece. It comes from ABC News in Portland, Maine. And one Portland student marked the end of the school year just as he started it on a bicycle. Kindergartner Alex Kimball told his father he enjoyed riding his bicycle so much that he wanted to ride it to school every day. Father and son made the several block trip daily, despite the weather. On Thursday morning, Alex's classmates gathered outside of school to cheer him on as he finished his goal. The six-year-old's efforts made his father, Nate, proud. It was a real treat to see him have a goal and really want to stick to that. I think it was a good sort of life lesson for him, and I'm proud of him, Nate Kimball said. Alex rode about 170 miles by the end of the school year, and he's thinking about bicycling to school next year, too. So I guess Alex got the bicycle gene that we often talk about here on the show. What a great little kid. And as long as we're patting kids who ride on the back, here's one from listener Gary V. in Southern Ohio, or maybe he's in Central Ohio. I'm not sure where. He sent me a note on Facebook, and he said, "Hi, Diane. I'd just like to give a shout-out to the junior racers from Ohio going to the national champions in Madison, Wisconsin over the 4th of July week. My son Nicholas is racing the 15-16 road and crit races. He races for ProChain / Turner out of Cincinnati. He is also a type 1 diabetic." So go Nicholas. Pretty cool. So, of course, two great stories about kids. Now I'm going to catch you up on one that isn't so great. This is actually pretty ugly. Phoenix teen accused of fatally shooting bicyclist. This is from Tucson News Now, posted by Steve Stout on CBS 5. A teenager is in custody in connection with the fatal shooting of a bicyclist in Northwest Phoenix in June, authorities said. Phoenix police said Monday that the 17-year-old boy is being held on suspicion of first-degree murder and misconduct involving a weapon. Phoenix officer James Holmes said 51-year-old Arnold Hamill was riding near 17th Avenue and Hatcher Road about 2:45 a.m. Thursday when a white pickup truck slowly drove by. A man fired multiple shots from inside the truck, hitting the bicyclist. He was taken to a Phoenix hospital where he died. Investigators say that the teen and Hamill had had some sort of brief argument before shooting. Like that's any reason to carry a gun and shoot somebody. So let's move on to something a little different. This is from Adventure Cyclist, and they posted this warning both on their website and on Facebook to those who want to ride in Canada this year. From Missoula, Montana, Adventure Cycling Association issued a strong warning to cyclists planning to ride its Great Divide mountain bike route in Canada. The organization, which developed and regularly updates the route, advised that because of the extraordinary flooding and flood damage throughout the provinces of Alberta and British Columbia, cyclists should not attempt to ride the Canadian section of the route this year. We understand that this is an unusual warning, but in all my years at adventure cycling, I have never seen such a complete washout of a route, said Carla Majernik, routes and mapping director of Adventure Cycling. We're receiving many reports of washed out bridges, destroyed roads, and fast-moving rivers and creeks, which could compromise a cyclist's safety, said Majernik. In our judgment, there are also no viable alternatives to the route. It would be much wiser for people to wait until 2014 to ride the Canadian section. For information on the flooding, cyclists can turn to Adventure Cycling's page on fires and floods affecting the organization's routes. Checking the box below the map for Alberta emergency alerts, you can get the latest on flood and damage warnings. Adventure Cycling also hosts a forum on temporary route closures. There are currently active threads featuring information about route closures in Alberta and British Columbia. And for those cyclists who would still like to ride the Great Divide this year, the U.S. portion of the route offers nearly 2,500 miles of off-pavement riding. You should note, though, that there are two wildfires that are causing closures in New Mexico. No kidding. So that's a warning that you should probably heed if you've decided to take your mountain bike out and do the Great Divide this year. Maybe this is not the right year to do it. And this is from London by Keith Weir on Reuters. Cycling sponsors can enjoy great value for money if they are willing to trust that the sport is finally leaving its dark doping days behind. Before the start of the 100th edition of the Tour de France last Saturday, cycling has been boosted by news that U.S. consumer electronics company Belkin will sponsor the former Rabobank team until 2015. The Dutch bank pulled out last year when cycling was reeling from the downfall of American rider Lance Armstrong, stripped of his 7 Tour de France titles after admitting to doping. However, a feared rush for the exits by sponsors has failed to materialize. The deal with California-based Belkin shows that companies still want to buy into a sport offering wide exposure to an affluent audience for a modest price. If they look at the fundamentals of the sport, they are really strong. More and more people are taking up cycling, says Lars Seer Christensen, chief executive of Saxo Bank, the Danish company which sponsors the Saxo Tinkoff team. It's a much better deal than other sports. The doping problem instituted a discount in pricing. Well, what do you think about that? So we've been talking a lot about sponsorship and whether or not sponsors would flee, and it looks like sponsors are looking for bargains and are getting them. So that's the news for this week. We are going to head right on over to Chandler, Arizona, and welcome Scott Embry, whose son Cyrus is a champion BMX racer. Scott, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
Thank you. Thank you, Dan.
Okay, so funny guy. You know, I gave you a great introduction as a wonderful dad who has this great kid, Cyrus, and then you just kind of drop it on me that, oh, by the way, I was national champion. So let's talk about that for a minute. When were you national champion and in what disciplines?
In 1979, Ron Skaren had asked me to be on the Southern California Team Pursuit Squad. And we went to Northbrook, Illinois, and we won the national championship that year in the team pursuit with Mark Whitehead, Paul Deem, Kevin Lutz, and myself.
I see. So you just kind of forgot about that.
I would guess I was thinking of more of Cyrus. He's the future. I am the past. The following year, in my natal town of San Diego, I won the 20,000-meter points race. And almost went to the Worlds, but didn't get a passport quick enough, and got to go to Japan and New Zealand. That was the year that we boycotted the Olympics. So it would have been the only, it would have been the only men's event that year in the World Championships, because it was not yet a Olympic event.
I see.
And it would have just been me and all the women.
I don't see anything really terribly wrong with that.
I missed out.
Well, let's talk about Cyrus a little bit. He had a rough start in life. Tell me a little bit about him and then how he became your guy, your little guy.
Sure. Well, here in Arizona and around the nation, actually, there's kind of a crisis of foster parent, not enough foster parents. We became foster parents, having learned of this problem, kids being left in homes and put in group homes, which are definitely not the best, simply because there weren't enough foster homes. Cyrus came to us at about 2 months old. He had already spent a month in the hospital and foster care, because he had multiple fractures from an abusive situation. And I guess the parents who were drug abusers left him with other people who were drug abusers so they could go out and drug abuse. And that was what happened.
So you went from being his foster dad to actually adopting him, yes?
Yeah, it became final in January.
Congratulations.
Thank you. We're very excited about that. Him and his little brother, who, to the best of our knowledge, is full-blood sibling, he came along while the case was still going, and so we got Cyrus at 2 months, but we got his little brother at 2 days.
So it was a two-for-one special.
It was.
So what's his little brother's name?
Daniel.
Nice.
Daniel loves trail riding, but he's not a big BMX racer.
So let's talk about that. When did you first put Cyrus on a bike?
Well, being a cyclist myself, and my wife also being a cyclist, we bought him one of those little Strider-type bikes with no pedals and low slung little 12-inch wheels, and I actually put it in his crib because there's all this extra room in the crib anyway, right?
Right.
And so he just looked at it and got familiar with it, and when he finally stood up, he stood up and you know, played with it a little bit, and he would walk it around the house long before he could actually kind of glide on it. And then at the same time, when he was about 18 months old, we got him a 12-inch wheel bike with training wheels. And he kind of went back and forth between the two bikes. And then when he was 3 or 5 days before he turned 3, he got up from his nap and found his 12-inch bike with no training wheels on it. He said it was broken. And Grandma said, "No, it's a big boy bike." And he got on it and been riding ever since.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, good for Grandma. Good for Grandma. So how did you transition him from Strider to the 12-inch bike to actually BMX racing? And evidently, he's totally into it.
Well, at age 4, we started thinking about getting him to the track. We didn't know that you can actually take him at age 2 and they can actually race on the little Strider bike. They actually, USABMX.com, I'll give them a little plug there, they have Strider racing from age 2 on, and they actually hold an event for them. Well, we didn't know that, and so by the time we got there, Cyrus was already pedaling his bike, and, you know, we just took him to see what he thought of it, and he loved it and started racing, at about 4.5, and by the end of his first year, he had gone through novice, intermediate, expert, and we found ourselves going to Tulsa, Oklahoma for the Grand Nationals, and he ended up second in the nation in the National Age Group, or NAG, point standings.
Wow. And he was how old? 4.5?
When he first started, he was just shy of 5.
Okay.
And then by the time he finished his year, because he turns, they say, age up. He ages up at the end of March.
Got it. So I know that one of the things that precipitated the conversation between you and me about Cyrus and about his racing was what it takes to get kids into cycling and then the support that parents and kids need to keep them cycling. And I know it's an outrageously expensive sport, especially when you're talking about a young child who now is growing quickly and is going to be moving into different bikes all the time. So without asking you how much money it costs to actually keep him in bikes and keep him in entry fees and all of that. What kind of support are you getting, if any, from, say, the BMX Association and or sponsors to help defray what are going to become more expenses if Cyrus keeps moving up in the standings?
Well, basically, it's a rich kid sport in that you can get a decent bike for under $1,000, well under, but you can go considerably faster on a $3,000 or $4,000 bike, which most of us parents are just unwilling to do, even if we could afford it, and we can't afford it. And so he's on that right about $1,000 bike, and he does pretty well. Parents will go really hog wild with the sport and travel. We have friends not far from us who are going to New Zealand, Auckland, New Zealand, for the World Championships. They went last year to the World Championships in Manchester, England.
Wow.
And this little girl is Cyrus's age.
And how is she doing?
She won World Championships last year, Grace Stevenson, and she will probably win it this year. So last year as a six-year-old, this year as a seven-year-old. But, you know, these are things that the parents themselves pay this. USA Cycling or USA BMX doesn't help with this. They put on the event, but you get yourself there.
So I know that BMX is strictly, it's sort of a track event, meaning it's a closed circuit kind of track, and it's all, you can see the whole thing as it's happening. Who is building these facilities, and how are they being funded?
USA BMX, they are funded, in essence, they are a business. And so the money that comes in, you know, you pay $10 or $12 per race to race. And if you race two different, the 20-inch size and the 24-inch size bikes on the same night, you pay an extra fee to race the second bike. And so it's the money that comes into the track is what supports it. Some tracks are nonprofit organizations. I think two here in the Valley are. One is not. And so they can solicit grants and donations to help underprivileged kids, which we help one kid here in the neighborhood, Terry, to race. And those two tracks let him race free when we get him up there.
Has a group ever looked at crowdfunding for like a little team that you might put together? And
sure. This has been my dream. And actually, I bought a domain name called AmericanYouthCycling.org. We don't have the money yet to incorporate as a 501c3.
Right.
But there are three kids that are from underserved or underprivileged, less affluent people that we help to get to races and help to, you know, get equipment together and ask, put it out there on Facebook that, you know, so-and-so needs BMX pants or tires and so little by little we just sort of get together what they need.
You know what, we'll put that information on our Facebook page. I think it's really important to keep kids on bikes as opposed to having them go off and get on motorcycles or cars or stay inside and play with video games. I mean, I like the idea that kids go outside. Do you see Cyrus staying with BMX and then maybe moving up to mountain biking, or do you think he'll at some point move off? I know there are, you know, specific issues.
He, as you know, we're watching the Tour de France right now, the whole world, or
yes.
The whole cycling world.
Yes, we are.
And he caught it this morning and said he wants to race in the Tour de France.
Lucky you.
He has that build. He has that body type.
He does.
He's not a big, which at some point will probably take him out of BMX because the burlier, you know, more power oriented riders do better in BMX.
Sure. So the last thing I want to talk about is if you could give the parents of a youngster interested in racing a bike one important piece of advice, what would it be?
Boy, the biggest, most important thing, no matter how much you want to see them win, no matter how much you want to see them progress, always keep it fun. Kids love games. You can turn the hardest training session into the funnest game. And if you do that, they're going to get stronger. They're going to get faster. They're always going to love it, and they're never going to get burned out.
Well, you know what, Scott? I really enjoyed talking to you, and I learned so much about BMX and what's going on in the U.S., and I think it's the kids who are the future of our sport. We need to support them, so hopefully there'll be more funding for the youngsters coming up, and maybe things will start to change. I hope Cyrus has a great season. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Okay, thank you, Dad.
All right, Scott. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Scott Embry joined me from his home in Chandler, Arizona. He snuck that national championship stuff in on me at the last minute. What a great guy. Obviously a happy and dedicated dad. I enjoyed learning about Cyrus and some of the BMX racing that's going on in the country. I really think that this is where we have to get our kids back on bikes. So let's get right to our next guest, or should I say guests, Chuck Harmon, Rachel Apple, and the groups from the Bronc Lab School in New York City. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me.
Hello, Diane.
Hi. Everybody can say hi. Welcome back to the show. How's the ride going this year, Chuck?
It's going great. We've had thunder all around us, but very few raindrops that have hit us.
Wow, you're lucky.
Yeah, been a lot cooler than last year, and we've done probably over 100 miles. I'm not sure exactly how many so far, but we'll be finishing up in Oberlin on Saturday.
And where are you this evening?
We are at a beautiful little campground called Kokosing, just outside of Fredericktown.
Okay. How many kids are with you this year?
We have 7, and we're right in the middle of Amish country, so we're seeing some horses and buggies today.
Nice, nice. Rachel, welcome back. How's the tour going for you this year?
It's been great. As Chuck said, it's so much cooler this year, so that's been really, really nice. I think everyone has a lot more energy as a result.
Yeah, I am sure. So I'm going to talk to each of the 3 kids that you've picked out of the 7, and let's see what their experiences are of the ride. Kevin, how are you?
I'm doing fine.
How old are you?
I'm 15.
Okay, is this the first time you've been on a bike tour?
Yes, it is.
And are you enjoying it?
Yeah, I'm enjoying it so far. It's really fun, great exercise, and learning about the Underground Railroad.
What do you think about the whole Underground Railroad thing?
Well, it's a great thing that helped, freed slaves get to the northern states. And, it was a great thing to, help slaves, yeah.
That's true. It was a great thing. It's neat to be able to still be able to see it. So what has been most impressive to you about being in Ohio? I know you guys are from New York, so every year I ask, what do you think about Ohio?
Well, it's a beautiful state. I really do love all the farms and all the people from Ohio. I really do enjoy it here. And, it's a beautiful state.
How's the food?
Oh, the food is great. Yeah.
I mean, what's more important than that, really? Well, so when you get back to New York, I know there are things that you have to do to sort of report on this. What are you going to say? What do you think you're gonna focus on for your critique of this event?
Hard work and determination, and to keep on going.
Good for you. Very nice. Well, I hope you enjoy the rest of your ride, and Oberlin's a very cool little town. I think you're going to like it when you get there on Saturday. So let's pass the mic to Kimoni, and let's talk to him. Hi.
Hello.
How old are you?
I'm 15.
Everybody's 15, huh? Pretty much. So what do you think of Ohio so far?
I think it's great. It's way different than New York. It's very widespread and much more room. I like the people here also. It's nice.
And so are you having any difficulties riding each day? The number of miles? Did you find riding a bike like this to be hard?
There is some difficulty, but it's nothing that I can't manage. So I try hard to keep going. And, by the end of the day, I'm proud that I've done as much as I did.
No kidding. I wish I was out on tour, too. So what is your goal for the tour this year? What is it you'd like to bring back to New York with you out of what you've seen and done?
I want to bring back the experience of all the things I've seen on this bike tour, because so far what I've seen is great. And I want to share it with everyone that I know so that I can influence them to also try this out also.
You can actually sort of pay it forward and tell people about this, and then they can then opt to take this tour next year?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I guess I have one more of you. Jihad, are you there?
Yes.
So, are you enjoying yourself?
Yeah, very much.
You are. Okay. Is it nice to be away from home?
Yeah. I still miss my mom, but I think the separation is good.
Do you have siblings, brothers, sisters?
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you the oldest?
No, I'm the youngest.
Aha! Now I see. How has it been riding a bike every single day? Is that something you've done in the past?
No, I'm actually one of the less experienced bikers doing this trail, but I still find ways to catch up and manage.
Do you like riding the bike every day?
Yeah.
That's good.
And it's great exercise.
How's the food?
Food is wonderful.
I mean, we ride to eat. You know, that is the whole reason to ride, so you can eat all you want. So what do you think you're going to get out of this trip? What's the most important thing you'll be able to take back to New York with you?
My great-shaped body after this trip.
There you go. That's a great answer. Thanks. I appreciate that. Well, I hope all of you have a great time. Chuck, you there?
Yes, I am.
You know, you're just pretty amazing. Every year you take these kids sight unseen on a 300-mile ride. I think it's awesome. The kids are always wonderful to talk to and listen to and hear about their experiences. And thank you for letting me talk with them again. It's just great. And I hope you guys have a real safe trip.
Well, thank you. And the only thing I can say is this is my favorite week of the year, and I'm just happy that the kids invite me along every year and allow me to share in their adventure, because it's a special week for me.
And I am sure it is. Thank you so much. Have a safe rest of your trip. And we'll catch up with the Bronx Lab kids again next year.
Okay. Have a great day, Diane. Everyone say goodbye.
Bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. So Chuck Harmon, Rachel Apple, and the Bronx Lab kids, Kevin, Kimoni, and Jihad, spoke with me from on the road near Fredericktown in Ohio on their Underground Railroad trip that they take once a year, a group of kids. There are seven this year. I love talking with these kids and finding out what they get out of their trip when they get out of New York City into, you know, I don't think of Ohio as the wide open spaces, but I think they do. They have to qualify for this trip, and I know they also get credits for it at school, and they always seem to really have a good time. So that's my show for this week. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you have time to go for a ride and that your favorite rider is wearing yellow in the tour. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at wjcu.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at wjcu.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.